Mini-episode 844 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everyone, to FDH Lounge mini episode number 844. You have with you today FDH Lounge dignitaries Rick Morris and Ben Chu breaking down the trilogy, whatever you want to call it. It's Cavs Warriors 3, the NBA championship for 2017. This one, Ben, I've been trying to think of parallels to this, and that in the globalization era of sports, roughly the last 20 years or so with the rise of the internet, I can't think of any American-based sporting event that compares to this. I almost think on further reflection, you got to go back to another famous trilogy back in the 70s. Ali and Frazier, one of those fights, of course, was overseas. Ali Foreman, that was overseas. So it's almost kind of cheating in that sense because Ali was taking the fights overseas for something purely American-based that is making waves all over the globe sporting-wise. I don't know if there's been anything to compare to this.
No, Rick, and on top of it, it's weird because we've gone through the entire playoffs kind of expecting this. We kind of knew this matchup was going to come to a head at some point earlier, even just before the season even began. So anytime anything sort of happens like this in team sports, it's definitely something to take note of, and it promises to be an incredible finals.
It really does. It's pretty rare when you look at it. It's never happened in NBA history. The couple times that it's happened in Big Four sports history in this country, the Stanley Cup, 1954-56, my Detroit Red Wings and the Montreal Canadiens met three times in a row. In the NFL, 1922-1924, the first two times it was Chicago versus the Canton Bulldogs. By 1924, the Bulldogs had moved to Cleveland, so there's some Cleveland representation. 1952-1954, the NFL Championship, Cleveland Browns and Detroit Lions, and the World Series. 1921-1923, the New York Yankees and the New York Giants, who, of course, subsequently moved to the Bay Area. So while they were not the San Francisco Giants at the time, both markets have teams that have been or were in similar situations over a period of time. I was talking with Russ Cohen when we were doing our Stanley Cup final preview for this year. He was complaining the other night as the Pittsburgh-Ottawa game went into double OT. He didn't know where to book his travel accommodations yet because he's covering the Stanley Cup final. And I posted underneath on his thread, and I said, hey, buddy, if you were covering the NBA finals, you could have booked for the two cities last July. Because it goes like you said, Ben. We've known this was coming. We've seen it's coming. And for as much as, again, and Russ is very much a hockey partisan, and I get that. I don't a lot of times play favorites among the Big Four sports. I get where he's coming from. He's bragging about hockey has had much better playoffs at this point. I think the NBA playoffs, personally, I'll say, have been abysmal to this point in time. But as I said to him, all anybody's going to remember is the finals. The entire season was sacrificed for this. The entire playoffs, it seems, was sacrificed for this. You are going to get that supersonic clash of the worlds in the finals here. And in hockey, they're going to get a final matchup that is probably going to be very good, just like the rest of the playoffs, but it's not really going to stand out. So, like I said to him, life's not fair, but all anybody's going to be talking about is the NBA one and not the Stanley Cup.
Right, Rick, and it's nothing against the NHL. The NHL has had an incredible matchup of late, too. And I believe if we're looking at the totality of the playoffs and the argument that you made to that certain times the playoffs are more interesting and more memorable for those matchups. If I'm being honest, if you look back at the history of the NBA, most of the time, most of the series we remember are the finals. It's not exactly the 1985 Eastern Conference Finals or the 1981 Western Conference Finals necessarily. It's the finals matchup. And I think in terms of just overall how this is kind of materialized, it's incredibly great for the sport because people are going to be glued to their televisions to watch this. Whether you like parody, whether you don't like parody, it's still interesting, intriguing basketball that's played at its highest level.
You know, you're very much right about that, I think, when it comes to the finals versus the rest of the playoffs, because you look back, and those are the moments that you remember, and it's the exceptions to the rule that stick in your head, but those exceptions, I think, kind of prove the rule. I had a friend the other day on Facebook that posted a link to the Bird Stole the Ball video from whatever year that was, 1987 or whatever. So, you know, you remember that. You remember Robert Horry hitting big shots in certain games, but you don't even necessarily remember what year or what uniform he was wearing. Was he with the Rockets with that one, or was he with the Lakers? I mean, you're right about that, that anything that happens before the finals, we remember some of these things, but not nearly on par with what we remember with the finals.
Right, and it's not in terms of necessarily we forget the details. It's just most of the time when we think in terms of sports, we think in terms of championships. And it's just how we are as human beings when it comes to sports. We focus on championships and success in the playoffs. We don't necessarily remember specific, you know, points of things. Because I will know this too, there have been fantastic series in the East and West Finals forever and in earlier rounds of the playoffs. But at the end of the day, I pause to think of any NBA fan who will remember a specific game from a playoff series over something more memorable happening in the finals.
That's right. That's really how it kind of tends to go. And again, this isn't necessarily a conscious experiment that the NBA went through. It just kind of played out this way. But we're about to find out what happens when you sacrifice, essentially, how much people care at all about the regular season, all of the playoffs leading up to this, because, again, it was just a prelude to the inevitable. The first time the two teams meet on the stage, the third consecutive year in a row, and that really says something for all the times the Lakers and the Celtics met in the 60s and the 80s, that it never went three times in a row. So it ends up being a thing here now, and it's inevitable that, well, the starting point for this in some senses is the huge, the thunderous, and no pun intended to the team that he left here, but the free agent signing of Kevin Durant to the Warriors last summer. Obviously, that is a starting point for analysis here, but it seems like the starting point for analysis in any finals that he's in, seventh in a row, eighth all time, LeBron James for my Cleveland Cavaliers. Again, I'm upfront about my rooting interest in this thing, as we are always upfront on this program, but it's a weird kind of a thing, Ben, when I see the coverage of this, and there is obviously a nod to the fact that Kyrie Irving is a developing great player, hit the game winner last year in the finals, something that was really a defining moment for him. Kevin Love playing as well as he's ever played, looking a lot like Minnesota Kevin, as it was described by LeBron. But it's amazing the extent to which all the coverage for the Cavs nationally seems to center almost solely on LeBron, when I think you can make an outstanding point, and this is true whether the Cavs win or lose. I think this is the best team that LeBron has ever had around him. The teams in Miami were not noted for their depth. They were fairly top-heavy. The teams the first time around in Cleveland, really a lot of times weren't much to write home about. I think towards the end got a little better than people gave him credit for. But this year, when you got the likes of Deron Williams coming off the bench and Kyle Korver, a revitalized Derek Williams, Richard Jefferson, who's always dangerous this time of year because he's saving up for it all year seemingly, and on it goes. I think that one of the keys to LeBron having the year that he's had, people talk about the unparalleled efficiency at this point of being able to go 8 rebounds and 8 assists per game for the first time in a 14-year career while still scoring a lot of points. I think a lot of it is, yes, he's become even more cerebral. His already great mind is now perhaps unparalleled. But I think it's the synergy of him fitting in with what's around him. And I think David Griffin has masterfully put pieces around him that he can maximize. And Ty Lue is a chess player who can put the players on the court to maximize that. I think it's far more synergistic, Ben, than the national media gives credit for.
Right, and I think the makeup of this roster is clearly the best that LeBron has had during his timeline with the Cavaliers. And I think sometimes, too, and this is within basketball media or within the sports media just overall, is that we sometimes boil it down to stars
It's very much a process to be able to do that. And it's funny because this team reminds me a lot of ways. They are the realization, I think, of what I thought I was seeing 7 years ago. And I'll go to my grave saying that that last team LeBron had in Cleveland, again, for as much as people talk about the first time around in Cleveland, he really didn't have much to work with. By the time that he was done at the end here, had a 27-year-old Mo Williams still in his prime. Anton Jameson, yeah, at age 33, but 15.8 points per game. That's a guy who aged pretty well and gave you 7.7 rebounds per game that year, too. An old Shaq, but still 6.7 rebounds per game. You had Delonte West in there, no jokes, please. J.J. Hickson giving you a few things here and there. Booby Gibson coming off the bench. It's a thing where, again, I looked at that team then, and I really thought that they had a lot of possibilities with being able to go big, go small. Mike Brown, that's one of the things I'm going to be looking at here in the finals. He is not a guy that I have always noted for the ability to generate chemistry on a team, and that would be putting it mildly. So I think that they kind of underachieved with the pieces that they had at that point in time. This year's team, obviously it's a talent upgrade in most of the areas with the players that I just named there, but this year's team, I think, seems to be the realization of the dream of 7 years ago about being able to mix and match around LeBron. You go big, you go small, you try and dictate the situation when you can, you react to the other team when you can, and that is a must when you're playing the likes of Golden State with all the challenges they give you, Ben.
Right, and I think one of the big keys for the series for Cleveland is going to have to be spreading the floor, because the Warriors, if they're allowed to pack the paint against the Cavaliers, then it's going to turn into an issue of how does, if the focus becomes then clearly LeBron having to go for 40, 50-point nights, and I don't think that's the way the Cavaliers are going to necessarily win games in the series against Golden State.
That's right, and I think they realize that, and I think LeBron realizes that most acutely of all. He is very good at game planning with Ty Lue. They have a very good synergy between them as far as trying to figure out what to go. How to utilize the pieces. And as you said, spreading the floor, never any better than during the playoffs. And I go back to the game against Indiana, the big comeback game, which in a lot of ways was a turning point, because the first two games in the series against Indiana, it was like pulling teeth to get those wins. And even the closeout game was much along the same lines. But that was the first real instance of flipping the switch that we saw from this team. In the second half, the likes of Deron Williams out there, Kyle Korver, JR was out there, Channing Frye was hitting them. I mean, that was a thing where, again, ESPN, you talk about the national media, they ran a thing with a headline, The Big One, just because Kyrie and Kevin Love sat out the fourth quarter, which I thought was completely ignorant. The Cavs went with what worked. The players were able to put their egos aside and go with what worked. And I'm sitting here going, The Big One? I was tweeting during the fourth quarter, people should be naming babies after Channing Frye after the night that he had tonight. So you're absolutely right when you talk about stopping the other team from packing the paint. That game right there is the ultimate blueprint for what you want to do, not just to Golden State, but to anybody. Because if you got those guys out there hitting those shots and wide open paint for LeBron, pick your poison, buddy.
Mm-hmm. I think the big thing is, if you're trying to game plan against this incredible Golden State team right now, is you're going to have to find a way to limit second chance points, and you have to also limit in terms of just letting the crowd at Oracle get into the game very early, because it's been proven over the last 3 years that if Golden State gets out to a 10, 15, 20-point lead early, it's over. It's going to be very hard to come back from that. I believe, if I'm correct, that if we include the regular season, in the last 2 years, they haven't blown a 20-point lead at home. So I think that looked more like world gangbusters than a combination of a Portland team dealing with the injury of Yusef Nurkic, Golden State having to just pretty much deal with a Kawhi-less Spurs team. It seems Golden State, I think, is still the favorites in this series, but the real question will become, and very similar to last year, does the specter of not having a challenge before they get to the finals loom into a problem?
I agree completely, and again, I'm going to make this very clear. This is my words, not yours, when I say the accidentally on purpose injury of Kawhi Leonard by Zaza Pachulia in a game where they were down 20-some points. So you talk about them. Again, they didn't even prove they could beat San Antonio at full strength. Ultimately, when you look at that, and people want to talk about the flawless path to the finals here, that's a thing where it's very much an open question how that series goes. Leave aside the intent, Ben. Let's push that to the side for just a second. Intended or not, they were getting dominated in that game by San Antonio. That's not to say it would have been a microcosm of the series, because I think that series had six or seven games written all over it based on the way it was going. But it's a very, very different path based on that. I have to say, and I'd be very interested to know what you think, I have kind of a cause for optimism as a Cavs fan. I was sitting here last year going, I want them pushed to the limit. I'm thrilled that they had to go seven games against OKC. I was loving that. This year, once it became clear they were going to dispatch San Antonio without Leonard pretty easily, I was loving the whole 10 days off. Because I got to tell you, with them being such a rhythm team, and the Cavs, the key to beating the Warriors for the Cavs every time out is disrupting the rhythm. I go back to game one 2 years ago, and it was pretty ugly in the first quarter on both sides. But to me, Golden State is much more prone to that kind of ugliness off of a 10-day break because everything has just been so effortless. They've been gliding. It's just they've been going through space, and nothing's been getting in their way. I think those 10 days off could kind of be a slap in the face when they get out there the first time and try to pick up where they left off in terms of rhythm. What say you?
I think overall, I don't think for Golden State that's going to be much of an issue because they right now played so far through these first three playoff series with little issue outside of the, well, if I'm remembering correctly, Portland game, game three and the San Antonio game one. It seems pretty pedestrian for Golden State, and I don't think that it's a big situation for them to have this much rest. I think in this narrative, I think it helps them a little bit more than it hurts them in comparison to prior years. But I have a sinking suspicion, at least how this series is going to start out, is Golden State is going to definitely feel like they need to jump out on Cleveland early, because if they lose one at home of the first two to Cleveland, the series might be over and Cleveland might have already won. Because I think the way that the Cavaliers are playing and how LeBron is playing at this period of time, I find it very difficult to bet against that at that point.
I will say, and this is personally from my standpoint as a fan, not from an analytical standpoint, but it is very, very reassuring for me to hear you say something like that, because I know how much basketball you watch on a regular basis. Nobody is more following this closely than you. So that is to hear that Golden State could really potentially have their hands full with Cleveland is a prospect that I really want to spend some time thinking about. To go a little bit further on that, to drill down on it a little more, these are some of the things we heard about a little bit from some of the announcers in the last round here, and it amplified some things that I've been saying. And I want to get to some of the things about Golden State. I do want to get to that in a little bit here. But as far as it goes with the Cavs, I feel like, again, the obvious question coming into this series, I don't begrudge anybody for asking, how the heck are you going to stop Golden State? Because you add Durant to the Splash Brothers. You look at that. Draymond Green as a fourth option is not too shabby. So I understand where people are asking that question. But the announcers during the last round, it was very interesting on TNT, they were talking about this. You get K-Love in the flow the way that he was going. You get Korver popping him off the bench here. Kyrie was kind of reaching a new level even for him late in the series. Is it not an equally valid question to say and it won't happen for sure, but we could very well get to a point where Golden State has to face the question of how do we stop Cleveland?
Right, and I think that is a valid question to ask, but I think it's very simple. I think it boils down to this. Will Golden State be able to stop Cleveland? Will Golden State be able to stop because right now at this pace, this arguably, if you look at just the pure numbers alone, it might be his best performance in the NBA playoffs in his career so far. And right now, I do not see someone on Golden State who can singularly stop LeBron James. Clearly, Draymond Green is their best option, and he is arguably, probably should be the defensive player of the year this year. But you have to flip the script, because I think there is the narrative of how Golden State has played for the last 2 years and how incredible they've been. But I think sometimes when we speak about basketball is that we sometimes tend to forget that it's all a matchup-based game at the end of the day. And sometimes just because we can look at numbers and statistics and advanced stats of the incredible offensive juggernaut that Golden State has been so far this year, it's almost impossible to automatically seed it to when Cleveland clearly has the best player in the league right now.
Yes, I think that's definitely right. And again, if Green can do that, and again, with him now being the fourth scoring option for Golden State, they'll sacrifice as much as they need to, essentially, from his game, if he can help shut down LeBron to a large degree. Because if he can do that, that's a win for Golden State. And it's an interesting dynamic in this series, because I know in the finals last year there were a couple games where the Cavs won going away. One of them was Game 5 without Draymond Green. Game 6, to me, where the Cavs really won going away, was kind of an outlier. The expected outcome, I think, for any Cavs-Golden State game, and why Golden State justifiably is the favorite, is you're looking at a range of outcomes in every game where it kind of goes from the Cavs can win a squeaker to Golden State is going to win in a blowout. And that's your sort of expected range here. I don't necessarily think, and this is tipping my hand, I don't necessarily think Golden State's going to win the series, but I know they're going to win total points in the series. They could lose 4-2, and I'm telling you, they're still going to win total points in this series, because there are two games that are just going to be like brutal beatdowns probably on the Cavs. That's just the way that this kind of goes. Like you said, Golden State gets in one of those roles where basically nobody can stop them. You have to kind of write that night off and come back the next time and address it there. But what I'm interested in terms of this, that, like you said, close game, street fight, whatever, I too give the edge to the Cavs in these close games. And I think part of it is going to be, I'm going to go back to what I said before about Mike Brown. And that is going to be another very interesting subplot in a series that's not lacking for them. 10 years ago, him and LeBron went to their first finals together. And obviously, he ends up getting turfed out of Cleveland not once, but twice, actually. And again, a better coach than some people have given him credit for over a period of time. But I've always felt like generating chemistry with the lineups was his biggest issue. It was an issue for him in Cleveland. I think while the roster construction wasn't always necessarily perfect, I don't think he as a coach did the most with it. And I understand that we're dealing with a paint-by-numbers situation here, that Steve Kerr, being the genius that he has devised a push-button system for Mike Brown here. But we're going to get the points in a game, Ben, where he's going to have to step up. There's not going to be a push-button system. There's not going to be if A, then do B. He's going to have to make some calls on his own here. And again, in games where there hasn't really been that big of a challenge to Golden State thus far, there hasn't really been a challenge in terms of keeping both Curry and Durant in the flow of the game. And I think, again, if it comes down to Mike Brown having to manage how do you keep both Curry and Durant in the flow, I think that's a big win for the Cavs in terms of an advantage.
Mm-hmm. I do agree with the analysis you have there. The one question I do have, though, is that so far nothing seems to have run Mike Brown into any issues at this point.
Sure.
And in terms of the substitutional pairs, I'm highly critical of Mike Brown for the old days, but I think in terms of roster construction right now, I think the Warriors, like you said, it was paint by numbers. I think, to use another analogy, it's very similar to an Etch-a-Sketch right now, to where you know your limitations and you know your rotation, so you don't have to do as much tinkering as you necessarily would so far. Because I think we do have to give Mike Brown some credit, at least so far in the playoffs, because they have gone 12-0. There have been very few teams in NBA history, teams go 12-0 in the playoffs. And the coach, even if it is a paint-by-number or an Etch-a-Sketch, they still have to make sure their team wins consistently on a given night. The question then becomes is that, and the question I think Cavs fans have when he was their head coach, was Mike Brown seemi- seemingly when he does his rotations and substitutions, he likes to stick to them. He's very similar to coaches like George Karl and Con Fitzsimmons, that they like their guys, and they're not going to shift from their guys, even if something good or bad is happening. So the question is Mike Brown going to be able to be flexible enough if something goes wrong for the Warriors in during the series? And I think he will be able to make those adjustments. The question you do have to ask then is that if Cleveland jumps out on Golden State early and takes either game one or game two or wins them both, how will Mike Brown and Golden State respond?
See, that's a good question, and that's where, again, and we don't know how much Mike Brown's going to be challenged. That's the whole thing here, and how much he's going to have to take it off of autopilot. But, yeah, to the extent that he does, I say big edge for the Cavs, because Ty Lue is not a guy who has to necessarily consciously make a move to improvise. It's what he does all the time. I go back to the Indiana game before, and he's got the buy-in from his stars, Kyrie, Kevin Love, saying, that's fine, we'll sit out the fourth quarter, what's working is working. And that's a degree of flexibility that, again, we have to see if Mike Brown is going to be capable of that, because I think he may need to be capable of that at some point here. Before I ask you a few things, oh, go ahead, buddy, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just wanted to comment very briefly on that. And I think he actually will, because he did spend some time with being, you know, I keep forgetting if he was an assistant head coach under Kerr or if it was just a assistantship, essentially, after his previous situation. But I'm starting to think, in terms of that narrative, that the one benefit for Ty Lue was Ty Lue was coached by Phil Jackson.
Right.
And the one thing that you can definitely note during Jackson's time with the Lakers and with the Bulls was that he was not afraid to mess pink error with lineups during playoff series.
Right.
He would, if something wasn't working, he would bring someone else in to try and help it and fix it to work. And I think that will be the question that won't decide the series, but it could definitely impact the game if he wins the series.
Exactly. And I think when you look at different sports, when you look at a lot of times the pedigree of the coach in there, I think Ty Lue is an excellent example of the kind of thing that so many teams are looking for in terms of playing time under Phil Jackson, apprenticeship coaching-wise as an assistant with Doc Rivers, being a product of great minds like that, absorbing things from them. And I think that's what's helped to really kind of make him the natural that he is. Last thing I want to ask you about with the Cavs before kind of drilling down on Golden State a little bit, this is something I postulated to you off-air previously in looking at this here. Tristan Thompson, a guy who I think probably, it's a shame that, you know, the most that the national media really kind of tends to talk about the guy is for some of his off-court relationship type stuff, because for what he does on court, he is a guy where I pose the question to you, I think he might be the best player in the league who is not much of an offensive threat. And you can kind of go down the list here and look at guys, and I mean, there's a handful of others in there. Ricky Rubio is such a great distributor, but I think his lack of a shot really kind of hurts him more at point guard than it hurts Tristan Thompson. Even his free throws have gotten a little bit better. In the Boston series there, he was hitting them like a pro. He's been working with Kyle Korver on that. He's never going to be a guy that is going to be renowned for his offensive game, but the fact that they're not afraid to lob it into him more and not worry as much if he gets fouled, I don't know if that's just a short-term thing or if that's an improvement that's going to stick, but he's a guy where I've always kind of thought to myself, you know, if they took basketball, in terms of fans, if they took it a little bit more seriously in the city of Atlanta, he'd be public enemy number one. Because I go back to that playoff series and the way that he just ripped their hearts out with the offensive rebounds, and it put me in mind of what Ho Grant did to the Cavs in the 92 Eastern Conference Finals. When you got a guy who can keep these possessions prolonged, in this case with LeBron James, in the case of 92 with Michael Jordan, that just rips the heart out of the other team, the other team's fan base. Tristan Thompson is a guy who really is, I don't want to say an X factor in this series, because he's somebody that we should all be accounting for very strongly. But if he continues on and even continues to look a little bit better offensively as he did in the Boston series, that's one of those things that could be easy to overlook but could really be a key going forward.
Right, and I think for Cleveland to win a lot of these games in the finals, Rick, they're going to need to win the rebounding margin, and especially since if you control the boards against the Golden State-type team, it limits their second shot, it will miss, but they will either get the rebound and get another opportunity after the fact. The biggest thing for them is that as many offensive possessions as Golden State can have, the better odds that they have a chance to win a game, because their points per game skyrocket when you have additional opportunities.
Well, exactly, and for a Cavs fan, being, you know, trying to be an optimist like myself, I look at this. The only guy with as high as two offensive rebounds per game on Golden State is Zaza Pachulia, currently hurt. So that's something where getting those offensive rebounds, they're going to want to turn the tables on the Cavs. But it's a thing where they don't necessarily have the guys statistically right now. They're as good in there. Draymond Green, 1.3 per game. So Draymond Green is certainly capable of getting rebounds at any point in time here. But turning to Golden State and looking at this, another thing I'd said to you off air was that somebody at CBS Sports, I believe it was Matt Moore, in the course of it, and I have taken fault with some of his assertions over the last couple of years, but what I thought was an otherwise excellent breakdown of the series, he throws in something completely inexplicable to me about Golden State having the better bench. We've already covered all the different weapons that the Cavs have top to bottom on theirs, and I'm not putting down Golden State's bench because I don't think either team in this series has much in the way of weaknesses. That's what happens when you have two teams that loom above the other 28 in the NBA. It's all relative. So Golden State does not have a bad bench. They do not have a bench, in my estimation, on par with what the Cavs have in terms of options here. I know there's a couple guys you're looking at from that Golden State bench as far as being key, and I would tend to agree with you in the sense that if these guys can rise up, it's going to be big problems for the Cavs.
Right, and I think that was one of the lingering questions that everyone had at the beginning of the season, is that when you bring on a Durant-sized contract, how do you keep the rest of your bench rotation together? It ultimately, Rick, as you know, it comes really down to three guys. It comes down to JaVale McGee. Very obviously, he was one of those guys that has just been sort of a journeyman through the league. It looks like he's going to be out of the league after his last stint in Dallas, but he's just the perfect offensive weapon for Golden State because he can roam, he can rebound, he can get to the basket. It's all the promise of what we all thought he could be during his time in Denver as a big guy who could be lengthy on the floor, move around easily. He's going to be a very important part in this series because he might have to be the de facto rebounder for Golden State, because I'm not sure if Draymond Green's going to have enough time while guarding LeBron or other weapons on Cleveland, and I'm not 100% sure Zaza Pachulia is going to get that many rebounds in the series. Another guy we have to note for is going to be Patrick McCall, the rookie out of UNLV. It was a lot of, during draft night when he dropped, a lot of people were bemoaning the fact that Golden State had a chance at him because he pretty much was, what in my estimation, a pretty solid bench rotation type guy who can guard multiple positions on the floor, but has the athleticism to get to the basket. But I think the one major X factor for Golden State will have to be Ian Clark. And I think the major reason for him is that he's the one bench guy on Golden State at this time. Maybe you could argue it's Andre Iguodala, but we don't know essentially how healthy Andre Iguodala is at this point of his career. If he's the one guy that can stretch the floor, he did it during his time at Belmont. He did it at some group when he played for the Miami Heat in Orlando and other teams overall. It's just, if Golden State's bench can reach their full potential, this could be turned into a cakewalk for them, because the one benefit that you could argue for Cleveland's sake is that if Curry and Thompson or Durant both take time off the floor or take a percentage of time not together, then Cleveland will have an opportunity to keep pace. But if Golden State's bench is continuously just putting in baskets, it's very hard to stop.
I would agree with that. And I want to go down further down that particular rabbit hole as far as their bench, because I think this is one of the big keys to the series that I don't hear anybody talking about. And I look at it now. The minutes have been pretty manageable for the Golden State guys this year. Klay Thompson topping out at 34. From there, you've got Curry and Durant both coincidentally at 33.4. Something tells me they weren't out there and not out there at exactly the same moments during the season, so I don't know how that worked out the same. But Draymond Green, 32.5. From there, Iguodala, 26.3, and it really kind of plummets. Now, we talk about rotations getting shorter during the playoffs for teams sometimes. I don't know that that's going to be the case so much with these two teams, but the minutes allotted to the starters, particularly on the Golden State team, I got to think those guys are all right about plus or minus 40 as this thing's going on, because it becomes, who do you trust out on the floor at certain times? I go back to the potential of Game 3 against Indiana and the ability to leave out there for big stretches of time when you've got Korver and Deron Williams. But if you can even take it a little bit further, RJ, Derek Williams, some other guys like that. Shump's going to be getting a lot of time in there, spelling J.R. Smith, sometimes playing with J.R. Smith. The fact that every Cavs starter not named LeBron should have lesser minutes in the series than the Golden State Big Four, I see your point about Ian Clark, because if any of those guys can make a case for any kind of serious time out there to where you can give the rest with these guys to keep their numbers down around maybe 35 minutes per game, that might be a stretch, but if you could do that, obviously that's a game Golden State should win if they can keep the minutes of the Big Four down like that. But how do you see it playing out as far as the Cavs? Again, they have a deeper bench as far as guys that they're going to trust to leave out there. It's going to depend on these guys catching fire. Channing Frye, unlike last year, is going to have to play and shoulder some load. So how do you see that playing out? Because, again, I agree with you that I think the benches in this thing, in such an even series, that could be the thing that tips this.
Right, and I think this might be one of those rare times where we might actually argue that, because the greatness of both teams are that high right now. And I think for Cleveland, again, it seems very simple, but if they go with LeBron, despite Kyrie, Kevin Love, and all these guys who play playing well, if LeBron is playing at the level he's playing at, because right now a lot of people, including myself, argued he was playing at Jordan-esque type levels in the Boston series, it's going to be determinant on LeBron at the end of the day. And I think if he can get help and they can spread the floor and force Golden State to play defense, because if Golden State can just have to pack the paint or just have to do what they normally do, Cleveland is not going to win this series, because Golden State's offensive capabilities are just incredible. I mean, in terms of also one stat that I wanted to bring up too was their total point differential in the playoffs. Right now, they're, I believe, it's over 15.1. And that ties the record. That's above the record for the highest point margin in playoff history. So this team is going to put up some numbers. The question is that when Cleveland has their opportunities to win, will they take advantage of it? And I think at this point you would argue that they will. Just how everything's going right now.
I would think so as well. Now, before we drill into scenarios, likely outcomes here, how we see this playing out, I want to ask you, I want to expand a little more on what you're saying about LeBron, because I tend to agree with you in that there is no scenario for the Cavs winning where LeBron is not the best player on the floor. As great as Kyrie is, as much as he took over the one game against Boston single-handedly, again, it is LeBron and LeBron alone at this point in time who can elevate to that level to carry the Cavs over a team the likes of Golden State. So I agree with you in that sense, but I go back to kind of where I started with this when I talk about the synergistic elements of this here, and that LeBron has had the best year of his career, both from a combination of him getting smarter about how to play, understanding the game at a level that probably nobody else walking the planet does today, but then also what's around him and the pieces parts and how do you mesh with this unit, that unit, whatever. So the Cavs cannot win if his usage rate is astronomical. If it's a thing where, and you alluded to it before, he's got to go out there, he's got to get 45 or 50. No, that's a game the Cavs are not winning if that's got to be the case. So how do you balance this whole aspect of no man is an island, where LeBron can be playing at an elite level but still getting what he needs enough from the rest of the Cavs here to keep his usage rate in line?
Right, and I think the key will also be Cleveland's bench and just the offensive capability that they have now. With David Griffin getting Korver and getting Deron Williams, because as many people know, without Deron Williams on that bench, the Cavaliers bench has not looked good at points during the season, because they didn't have anyone else that could either score or distribute the ball. And the one thing that we all know about Deron Williams is that he can score and distribute the ball.
Yes.
So it's going to, I think the best way to keep LeBron's usage down, which is still going to be astronomically high, is to give him appropriate rest and hopefully build leads that you can give him 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, average at least 40, 42 minutes in this series.
Right.
I don't think you're going to get him. You're not going to rest him for a long period of time, barring a blowout or anything like that.
Right.
But it feels to me that the best way for LeBron to be successful has pretty much been the way he's been successful in the past, getting his teammates involved and using the one thing that he's always done, even if we go all the way back to his first for his rookie season, is being able to spread the floor and make appropriate passes and get others involved. Because that's been his game forever. And if he can do that to the optimal level that we all think he can, they have Cleveland has a very good chance of winning the series.
I think so as well. And I think it's going to come down to one of the things. I'm not going to say regardless of what the score is coming into the second quarter, because that's going to matter a lot. But one of the things I'm going to be looking at the most is what happens in the second quarter of a game when LeBron is out there with some of the bench guys, and it becomes a matter of how much can we ride these guys. I think that's going to be the opportunity every night to really kind of make things difficult for Golden State. You got Channing Frye out there popping them from three-point land. You get Korver engaged. You get those guys in there. You get Darren Williams to where you look at it and you go, wow, we can play him some minutes tonight, and we can really put Kyrie in bubble wrap for the fourth quarter. I think that's the kind of thing that could really be huge. Do you think there's a decent chance that the second quarter and the way the Cavs come out, again, it's going to depend a little bit on what the score is coming in. If the Cavs are down 18, then that's only going to get you so far. But what are your thoughts on that and at key points in the game that are going to tell us about how it might end?
And I think it's very simple for Cleveland. It's very simple for both teams, Rick. If you can jump out to a big lead, it's going to help. The one thing that favors Golden State is that if they're down by 15 or 20 points, it's a lot easier ground for them to catch up than it is for Cleveland.
Right.
Even though Cleveland's fantastic, having Durant, Curry, Thompson, and Draymond Green all on the floor at the same time, a 15, 20-point lead is not safe.
Right.
But if Cleveland can extend the game and force Golden State to play from behind, that is arguably their best chance at winning, or playing these sort of muck-up games where the score is low and they have to do that. Because it was proven, at least at some points during the Utah series, that Golden State has to jump out on teams. Because if not, then if a team can muck it up a little bit, they force Golden State to then have to play perfect basketball. And the thing is that when you have to play perfect basketball, there's little margin of error in a case like this for Golden State. Their error level is, I would say, a little bit lower than last year, but it's still there. There's still a level of error.
Let me ask you this, because I get the sense, in looking at this, that if you're Ty Lue, and it's a situation where Golden State's pulling ahead early, I would suspect you got to be pretty loose with the timeouts. Because realistically, you fall behind 15, 18, you're losing anyways. I think if you're Ty Lue, you got to burn almost every last one early on if Golden State's pulling away, and just keep trying something else. And again, they get up 15 or 18 and you just realize it's not your night. We move on to the next night. Obviously, if it's an elimination game, you can't approach it that way. But is your sense what mine is, that you at all costs try to stop that early Golden State blow away and keep it to a muck-out game where you can beat them late?
Well, the question, too, is that I think in the perfect world, Cleveland would want to muck up these games because it would make the most sense, because Golden State, albeit an incredible offensive team, they do struggle in slower games. And if you can keep it, it's been proven so far the model to beat Golden State is to muck the game up and force their shooters to be out of rhythm. And it seems that Cleveland has, as much as any team's league, the ability to do that. The question that becomes is how easy it is to do that. So far, no one has been successful enough, at least during the regular season or in its playoffs, to shut Golden State down multiple times during a series. And it feels like the thing for Ty Lue, I think he has to worry about the most, is in terms of how do I play some of these rotations, how do I think my team is going to be able to come back? Will I have a chance to win, to pull away early? Because the one thing you can argue with, Rick, too, is also in terms of calling early timeouts to stop runs. I've never been a fan of that.
Okay.
Only maybe because the home base at Oracle is arguably been one of the best for a long time now. And if they're just going bananas and going crazy, that's just going to pump that team up even more. And it's been kind of proven so far when Golden State has faltered or had their issues is when they're forced to play a sort of game where the tempo is dictated by the other team and not them. Because if they're already dictating tempo, you're probably not winning that game.
That's probably right. And as I said before, I think there are a couple games in this series where Golden State is just going to pull away, and there's nothing the Cavs can do about it. Because to me, it's a matter of Golden State having the higher ceiling at this point and the lower floor. Because if it's a muck-up game, we've seen it last year with the defense that Tristan Thompson plays in a way that they disrupt the screens, JR and Shump getting in the jock of the guards there. I think that if you're looking at a grind-out kind of a game, as I think most of them in the series will be, I'll give the advantage to the Cavs most nights, again, stipulating that Golden State's likely to win a couple in a blowout. I'm looking at this in terms of predictions, and I've been right the last 2 years because, again, 2 years ago the Cavs came in. They'd already lost Kevin Love. Kyrie Irving was limping around on one leg at that point. I'll go to my grave believing that breaking the kneecap came in part because it was happening on an already injured knee. I think the foundation there probably wasn't very good. So with the Cavs not at 100%, I didn't think they'd win 2 years ago. I might have oversimplified last year on thinking that Kyrie and Love coming back was going to give it to the Cavs. Then again, Kyrie hits the game-winning shot in Game 7, so maybe I wasn't oversimplifying. I don't have nearly the sense one way or another looking at this year that I did each year when I was right subsequently here. Feels like a coin flip, but I've been saying for a while now, I think it's 51-49 Cavs based on some of these elements that we're talking about. And at the end of the day, we may get a chance to see Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Klay Thompson to whatever degree, prove that these guys are some of the best closers of a generation. None of them have done that to this point. And at the end of the day, I go with what I've seen rather than with what projecting may happen. And Golden State, and again, they have it in them. They could win this. They can't win this in a sweep, I do not believe. They can win this in five games. If they're completely on, they win this in five games. You got to say they're one of the top two or three teams of all time if they do that. As a Cavs fan, I just have to take my hat off to them if it happens. The scenario for the Cavs doesn't get any better than six or probably seven games to win it in. I'm going to go with the same thing last year. Game 7 at Oracle, we've seen that the Cavs can do it. Golden State's better than they were last year, but oh, by the way, so are the Cavs. Didn't have Kyle Korver last year. Darren Williams for Delly. I love Delly. I'll go to my grave loving everything that guy did for the Cavs, but Darren Williams is an upgrade. And on it goes here. We have a better Kevin Love than we saw a year ago as far as being more integrated into the system. By the narrowest of margins, and maybe a late three-pointer again, I say Cavs in seven. What say you, Ben?
One point I wanted to make before the before my predictions, I wanted to note because we do have to talk about Kevin Durant a little bit.
Yes.
He is possibly the most important star for Golden State in the series. He proved that over the San Antonio series, and he did that also during their first-round series against Portland. Because
right.
It's going to be, we kind of already know what to expect from Curry and Thompson and Green to spread the floor. If Durant is playing an MVP-type level in the series, I think Golden State at that point easily wins in five. But kind of so far what we've seen with this Golden State team is that is just running through the regular season, running through the playoffs with little issues, and then having to play a relatively tougher series than they would like. And so far, I was just judging off the stuff. I'm kind of essentially taking off the point you said. The two most likely outcomes of the series is Golden State in five or Cleveland in seven. Again, in my mind, by the slimmest of margins, like I said to you, I also believe it's Cleveland in seven, only because I think LeBron is playing at such a high level right now that I just cannot conceive Cleveland at least not getting two at home and one early on in the series on the road.
There is one thing that comes to mind, one last question based on what you said there, and I had referenced this before, how critical it has been in terms of disrupting the rhythm of the Splash Brothers with everything that Tristan Thompson has done, you know, coming out and making the switches and everything like that. The fact that, again, you could say LeBron is going to obviously have something to do with helping to shut down Durant, but everything LeBron does defensively takes away from what he's going to do on the offensive end of the court, and the Cavs can't afford too much of that. Hence, you got to believe Tristan Thompson is going to be very much involved at that point there. It's hard to imagine that you're going to isolate Kevin Love on Durant for long stretches. So is there any worry whatsoever about the fact that it might dilute Tristan Thompson's effectiveness against the backcourt, the fact that he's going to be more involved on Durant?
I think it can, and I definitely think it would be intelligent for Golden State to be is to force Durant's hand, per se, during games, because he's a very good transitional scorer. He's very good in terms of certain matches, because I don't think we've seen a player of his caliber since George Gervin, who is a relative matchup nightmare for anyone who has to guard him. Because if you put a big on Durant, he might beat them with his quickness. If you put a small on Durant, he's just going to shoot over them. So I think that he's going to essentially turn. He's going to be a huge part of the series. I don't think he necessarily decides, because it's kind of naive to think that Durant by himself on a team with Curry, Thompson, and Draymond Green has to put together a unworldly performance. But he is a big part of this team, and the one thing that he can definitely do, which Golden State surprisingly last year didn't have, is that when Curry and Thompson were not scoring, Golden State was in trouble.
Right.
Now with a consistent scorer like Durant, that issue is not as apparent, because Durant can carry the team if he needs to for that timeline.
That's true. And I would agree with you, and I would go further as to say, I think out of all the huge stars in this series, I would say Durant is probably the biggest X factor. That, yeah, if we're seeing peak Durant in this series, it's very difficult to imagine the Cavs winning, because peak Durant is going to lead to a good chance of peak Curry and peak Thompson as well, in terms of the looks that they're going to get. And that's where the landslide possibility kind of comes in. And like I said, I think there's going to be probably two games in this series that go that way. I think the rest of them are going to be dogfights. That's why I join you in saying Cavs in seven. And I can only hope that we'll be right. And I will tell you this, Ben, I am going to open this series by wearing my Cavs Chinese New Year shirt. Again, FDH Director of Research Nate Noy gave that to me last year. He went to Cavs Chinese New Year night. I never broke it out before Game 5 of the Finals. Wore it the last three games. I'll be wearing it Game 1. I'm actually going to be watching it in a loge. Fellow FDH Lounge original dignitary Chris Galloway is getting a loge at the Lake County Captains game, watching a little minor league baseball Thursday night. We'll have the NBA Finals on, obviously, in the loge there. So I'll be rocking Chinese New Year, Ben. It's 3-0 in the Cavs for the Finals so far, and may that run keep going.
Yeah, I hope for your sake, hopefully it does, because I wasn't sure if he broke it out during the Indians loss to the Cubs, but we will see what ultimately happens, because I think it would be very, the word I would say, Rick, it would be very sort of, God, I hate to break out this word, but it would feel very anticlimactic if this series was to end in five for Golden State, because then I think overall we would just be like, well, what we assumed from the beginning of the year, guys, Golden State's incredible, and they're just going to be impossible. It just seems like the flow of how the season has gone so far, that we're leading up to sort of a heavyweight championship bout type of final.
It really kind of is that, because, again, you have the defending champions in the Cavs, and, again, the NBA so often is a style-over-substance league. In many ways, in a style-over-substance league, Golden State's the defending champs because they won July. And a lot of times in the NBA, July tends to trump the actual results on the court as far as public consumption goes. So you have essentially two teams that the public has deemed the heavyweight champions of the world, the actual champions and the champions of July, and here they square off. And maybe not for the last time. We shall see. I mean, early front runners for next year as well. I got to say, from a Cavs standpoint, a Golden State decisive win makes it hard to look at next season and see where it's going to necessarily get that much better. So there's a lot on the line for the Cavs, but I think that may be where they have the advantage in urgency. Golden State is trying to do something that nobody's really done. Put it all together, put the super team together in the first year, but they have the luxury of knowing, much like it happened in Miami. It took a year for the big three in Miami, but every team that does this wins a title. Golden State's going to get theirs. If you're the Cavs, there may not be any tomorrow. So I don't know if that's a psychological edge.
And I think it possibly could be in this sense, is that with, especially with Cleveland too, is that they've already done it before. They've come back from, you know, deficit that no one else had prior done it. And it feels that there is a sense of urgency for the Cavaliers. I mean, I would agree with Golden State. They have the same sense of urgency. But they also realize that coming up in their near future, they have a very great opportunity to win 3, 4, maybe even 5 in a row. And I think for LeBron's case, even though he is doing ungodly things at this time, his career is nearing that midpoint to the end type narrative.
Right. And we are just blessed to get to see it all play out. It's going to be obviously such a nail-biter for me as a fan to watch, as one of the two teams involved in this is my lifelong team. But it is going to be just absolutely magical. And as we said at the outset, just a spectacle all over the world. As I told you off-air from following the Cavs on Facebook and from making some comments in there, I actually picked up a freaking Facebook friend from the Philippines this past week. I mean, there are Cavs fans and Warriors fans all over the world in their own communities here and banding together and rallying for their teams. And this is going to be something we'll probably be talking about till we're old and gray. But a pleasure breaking it down with you, as always, my man. I can't think of anybody else I'd rather have in here to do this with. A splendid conversation, as always.
I appreciate it, Rick. Bring back our phonics.
All right, buddy. This is going to be an amazing series. Great to break it down with you. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge Mini Episode number 844.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.